7 a.m. meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual and our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women on Zoom tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Beth is coming back as a Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip speaker. She is very active. She is plugged into the program. I know she sponsors a lot of women. She goes to a lot of different meetings. Her home group is the Morning Miracles group of Oakwood.
Fresh Air.
And the Fresh Air group at the Hawk Club.
Yep.
And I'll let her speak for herself here.
Okay. Hey, y'all. I'm Beth, and I am an alcoholic. I will tell you, this is so scary. I see lots of familiar faces, but I am the blue chip Zoom guinea pig for tonight. This will be the first time we've tried a speaker meeting on Zoom. I want to say that I have some of my Earth friends on tonight, which it's a great honor. I have my friend Kim and Tracy. My friend Elizabeth is listening in, and I invited them because they walked with me through this journey, and I just want to say how important they are to me. And, I want them to see what this program is all about, and the friend that they knew and loved. And the transformation is all because of AA. My sobriety date is January 18th of 2008. That's 4,449 days ago, but of course, who's counting, right? It has been an honor and a pleasure to be a member of AA. You know, it was bumpy the first year, but since that point, it has been wonderful. Usually when I tell my story, I always ask if there's anybody with 30, 60, 90 days or less, because I know that for me, those are the most important days, and I tried to hold on to everything that I heard during those times. I ask people, do they have any idea when they're in AA how lucky it is that we are here? The statistics say that only about 3% of the people that walk in the doors of AA ever make it. I don't know about you, but I am dang glad that I'm part of that 3%, and I've been given that gift of today. I do like to read out of the Big Book when I tell my story, and I always like to start off with the foreword to the third edition, and it says something like that. In spite of the great increase in the size and span of this fellowship, it is at its core, it remains simple and personal. Each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. Tonight, that's all I've got to offer is my experience, strength, and hope. I have a sponsor. She's with us tonight, and my sponsor has a sponsor, and I think that's incredibly important. I have sponsees. Two of those women are with me tonight, and they have made my recovery come to life. I appreciate you. One of them is tuning in from Rhode Island. once one of the old timers in a meeting said to me, or they made the announcement, hey, you know, if you need a sponsor, you need somebody like Beth. You probably won't like her, but she knows the steps and she'll help you stay sober. To me, that wasn't a slant. That was a high compliment. I love those steps and I love this program. And my sponsees will tell you that it is life or death. So let's talk about what it was like. I was born in 1964, 55 years old, so that all of you out there that don't know how old I am, you can go ahead and figure that out. You don't have to sit there and guess and take away from my story. I believe that in 1964, Beth Buffington was born an alcoholic. I refuse to get into a big psychological debate over that because I'm on the side of this and all of you are muted. So we can't have that kind of fuss tonight. But I believe that I came into this world an alcoholic. And yes, I know me better than anyone. I was born into a family of moonshiners, coming from North Georgia in a time that was post-cotton. That was basically all there was. There was a little farming. Poultry business had just gotten started in the 50s here, but moonshining was hot and heavy. Came from a family that I would guess would be dry drunks. They had all the isms of alcoholism, but they were teetotalers. My daddy once told me that you don't drink the moonshine because you'd be drinking up profits. So, you know, that's the world that I was born into. But you know what? That's them, and this is me, so let's get on with the story. So I lived the first 9 years of my life in East Hall County, and we lived in a small trailer. I probably had everything that I needed. I learned to play. I had loving family and extended family, big family. But, you know, it just wasn't quite enough. Not that I wanted for material things. I wanted harmony. And from the time I was a very little girl, peace and harmony wasn't something that surrounded me. Had a tumultuous family life. Parents loved me and my sister dearly, but my dad, part of the ism was that he loved women. So from the time I was very young, I understood why it wasn't that he wasn't home very much, and it wasn't just work that was drawing him away. And so part of the reason that I believe that I was an alcoholic from birth is that I wanted to control things. I wanted to make everything all right, as most kids do, but I would do anything and say anything to change the situation. And looking back, it's hard to believe that a child of 4 or 5 or 6 years old was already developing an ego that, again, would say or do anything to make everything in my world okay. Let me go ahead and talk to you about my first drink. I'll skip ahead just a little bit. And for you non-alcoholics that have joined us tonight, you probably have no idea what your first drink was. But most every time I've heard an alcoholic tell their story, and all of you alcoholics can agree, we remember the day that we took the first drink. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was the summer right before I turned 14. I was in Jekyll Island, Georgia with my best friend, and we were at a BPOE convention, like the Elks Club, and the boy's name was Scott. He was my best friend's older brother, and he had cold duck. I don't even know if they sell cold duck anymore, but I remember he poured us a little plastic cup. And he poured that cold duck in, and I remember tasting it, and the difference it made was incredible. From the first drink of alcohol, I was in love with it. And for the next 30 years, I had a love affair with alcohol. I tried to break up with it a whole lot of times, but it wouldn't let me go. So from that day, I knew that I loved it because it changed the way that I felt about everybody, and mostly it changed the way that I felt about myself. Shortly before that happened, my sister and I learned to drive early out in the country. Like 7 or 8 years old, we'd be put in a pickup truck and sent off in the pastures, and we'd go drive. Well, I spoke of my dad's infatuation with women outside of the marriage to my mother, and there was one particular woman, and again, I thought that I could change things, and if I could change things, then everything would be okay. And this one particular woman didn't live too far from our house. And I know I was younger than 12. So one Saturday morning, I decided that I was going to her house. And I was going to talk to her. And I drove over to her house. I knocked on the door. And I said, "Do you know that you are ruining my life and you're ruining our family?" To which she said, "If your daddy was happy at home, he would stay at home." And those words changed my life. And shortly thereafter is when I found that magic cup of alcohol. It was my answer to the pain. It was my answer to acceptance of the things I could not control. So, between that age of 14 and 16, I made up my mind that the solution would be for me to make a geographic change. And at 14 years old, the only way I could think that I could get out of the misery was to go to college. So I started my pursuit of early acceptance. When I was 16 years old, I was accepted to Emory University in Atlanta. And that had to, I was sure that would have to be the solution to all my problems. That was just the beginning. Because at 16 years old and a fake ID in Atlanta, Georgia, I had the world to myself. And the drinking just escalated. I made it all through college. I lived in Italy. I lived in Greece. I did an internship in D.C. Went to graduate school where I met a wonderful guy. He was going to be an orthopedic surgeon. And not only did my drinking get in the way, but my insecurity is really what ruined our relationship. In the first year of graduate school, my dad developed cancer, and he said that he was going to get this mistress, the same one who had been in the picture all along, to take over the company. Well, I made the decision that that wasn't going to happen, so I left graduate school, I left the orthopedic surgeon, and I abandoned everything that I knew and loved because of ego. I came home and went to work for my dad. I was able to wedge this woman out, and to cover up the misery of the loss, my drinking started. I want to read from the Big Book, page 427. And it's the story Window of Opportunity. It's very similar. It's a guy that writes about going off to college. And, his story is similar to mine. But the part that struck me when I read it that has been the theme of my life since I was a very little girl goes like this. he was at a speaker meeting, and he said, the speaker said, if you're an apple, you can be the best apple you can be, but you can never be an orange. I was an apple, all right, and for the first time, I understood that I had spent my life trying to be an orange. I looked around at a room filled with apples, and I was understanding the speaker. Most of them no longer were trying to be oranges. So, yes, from the time I was a little girl, I didn't want to be an apple. I wanted to be an orange. And talking a little bit about my pursuit, my education, my desire to be a doctor's wife, you know, those were all things, looking back, all ego-driven things that wanted this apple, just wanted to be an orange. I'm still at the highway construction company from 1985 on. In 1990, I married a nice guy, married for the wrong reasons. I was a little country girl, red apple, and I wanted to be a city girl, orange. So I married into a family that I thought would bring me the social status that I had always dreamed of. But with that social status came a family, unlike mine, that drank at every occasion. The Bloody Marys flowed, and since that was the the thing that seemed to bring me peace, I fell right in, and it also. I didn't fit in. That wasn't who I was. And so I learned that to survive within that family, I had to drink. So from 90 to 94, you know, I drank socially, drank too much, drank at the wrong times, but it hadn't started to cause consequences. But in 1995, I really realized for the first time that I had a problem. In 91, when I was pregnant with my daughter, it was easy for me to stop drinking. But by the time 1995 rolled around with my second child, I wasn't able to stay sober the 9 months. And from 1997 to 2001, the drinking picked up and I became a blackout drinker. In the year 2000, things got rough. I separated from my husband. Drinking, his drinking, my drinking, it was a terrible combination. At Christmas of 2000, we were going to separate, and he made a decision to try to save our family. The way that he tried to save our family was he attempted to take away my three children. So on New Year's Day of 2001, I committed to sobriety, and I did it to get my kids back. So from January 1 of 2001 to January 1 of 2002, I stayed sober. On January 2nd of 2002, after a year of sobriety and an attitude that, oh, you know, I was sober a year, anytime my tail gets in a crack, I can do it again. The next day, I took a drink of alcohol, and within a week's time, I was back to where I was the year before. So you've heard it said that while we are sober, our disease is out in the parking lot doing push-ups. Well, I'm here to say that my disease was alive and well, even though I white-knuckled it for a year. So from January 2nd of 2002, let me back up and let me talk about that year that I was white-knuckling it. I did not get a sponsor. I did not work the steps. And I only went to enough meetings to keep my family off my tail and enough to keep the kids in my household. And from 2002 to for the next 5 years, I drank and I drank and I drank. So in January, in late 2005, after a series of drinking affairs after the divorce, in late 2005, I met a wonderful man. At that point, the verbal abuse by my father had gotten so intense that it was a terrible cycle. He was constantly verbally abusing because I was drinking, and I was drinking because he was verbally abusing. And it was a terrible, terrible cycle. So in late 2005, this fast-talking alcoholic met a slow-thinking Al-Anon and was able to charm him right in to a relationship. He was a wonderful man. He was solid. And I think, looking back, that I knew deep down in my heart that at that point I didn't think I'd ever stop drinking, but I thought that he would be a good man to settle my affairs and take care of my children when I died. He was incredible, just a solid guy. And in August of 2006, something happened that would truly set my sobriety in action. My father died. It was the oddest feeling of relief and grief at the same time. Relief from the abuse, but incredible grief that the person I probably loved the most was gone. In 2007, that good man that I was sure would take care of my affairs after I died, and I got married. Shortly thereafter, my end, or my beginning, started. We got married in September, and by November, I had gone to bed drinking. The year after my father died, I had to carry on the business. I had to carry on the family. My ego was telling me, you know, be strong. My ego was way out of control. And yes, I was still an apple that wanted to be an orange. You know, I wanted to be successful. I thought now that my dad was gone, the pressure would be off. You know, all those crazy excuses. But the misery increased instead of decreased, and the alcohol consumption increased. By November of 2007, I had gone to bed. I had gone from a functional alcoholic, whatever that oxymoron is, to a woman who could not get out of the bed. And the last time I told my story, I told them that I knew my ego and my vanity were out of control because I hired a lady to come in the mornings, get me out of bed, put me in the shower, put me back on top of the bed in clean clothes because I was sure that when I died, I didn't want anybody to see me in dirty clothes. I made it through the holidays. I wasn't able to Christmas shop or spend Christmas with my children in 07. My poor sweet husband David was literally put through hell. Sometime around Christmas, I was laying in the bed and I said, you know, I cannot kill myself drinking. I wanted to die, but I wanted to live. And for some reason, a tiny pin light of hope appeared, and I started to think about the idea of AA again. It had been 7 years, and I had gotten just enough AA to think that it might work. So in January of 2008, I started to look for rehab facilities. I was going to give it one last shot. Sometime around the middle of January, I set the date of January the 17th, to go to rehab facility. So I called my mom and I said, Mom, you know, I need you to take me to rehab. So at that point, I was drinking about a half a gallon of vodka every 36 to 48 hours. And I tell that as part of my story, not as a drunkalog, but when people see me put together, they don't understand always how far down the scale I had gone. So I had consumed all of the alcohol in the house, and there were two bottles of Dom Perignon, very expensive champagne, left in the fridge. And the night before I was scheduled to go to rehab, I consumed both bottles. Sometime before daylight, I was incredibly sick, and I threw all that up. So when my mom came to take me to rehab, she picked me up, and, you know, at first, when I selected a rehab, I wanted to go, like, to Malibu or to Florida. I was sure that the sunshine and spa therapy would cure me. But something deep down said that's not what this apple that wants to be an orange needed. I chose a first-class nut house. I checked in with the schizophrenics and the psychotics and the addicts, and they all put us in the same little paper gowns, and they took away our shoelaces, and I spent 7 days being humbled, 7 days where my ego was beat down to the point where I surrendered. After that detox, I went to Talbot Recovery Center in South Atlanta, and I spent 16 weeks. At that point, I was so beaten down and so desperate that I didn't care what happened. I was willing to stay as long as it took. A couple of important things happened at Talbot. It's a wonderful facility. And again, I'll go to the 12 and 12, page 21. And I don't know why this brought me so much peace. For normal people, it wouldn't be something that they were that you'd be proud of. But for this alcoholic, I was proud when I read these words, and it goes something like this, and it's in step one of the 12 and 12. Step one says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. There was no doubt in my mind that I was powerless and that my life had become unmanageable. And it says this, who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one, of course. Every natural instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. It is truly awful to admit that, glass in hand, we have warped our minds into such obsession for destructive drinking that only an act of providence can remove it from us. I was so stinking happy to hear that my mind was warped from alcohol and that it wasn't some kind of moral failure on my part, that I had simply warped my mind. On page 416 of the big book, it talks about that we have a disease, that it is not a moral issue, and that it has nothing to do with willpower. That was one of the biggest sighs of relief that I had, because I couldn't figure out how I could be a successful businesswoman and be a good mother and run a half marathon and not stop drinking. That absolutely baffled me until I learned that that is the nature of alcoholism. And also at Talbot, I think one of the most important things that I read in the big book and that I read now in the big book is on page 417. And it says, an acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it's supposed to be at this moment. Acceptance. I'm still working on that every single day. But I've been in this program long enough to know that if I can accept that God has a plan for me, if I can accept His will for me and not take my will over on a daily basis, then everything is going to be okay. Part of that acceptance is that I am so happy today to be an apple, because we sit in a basket of some mighty fine apples every time we go to an AA meeting. I'm proud. I was explaining to someone who's very special in my life today that my mistakes and my alcoholism are part of who I am. I was given a second chance, and I try to live 2 days for everyone. Trust God, clean house, and serve others. That's been my motto, and you hear me say that mantra over and over again in meetings. Miracles. I am a miracle. I see miracles in my sponsee Jenny, in my sponsee Katie, in my grand sponsees. I see miracles in that person who grabs that 30-day chip. You know, the one that comes in and they're shaking so loudly that their chair is rattling. I see miracles. I see God and everybody in the program. The last 18, 19 months of my life, my husband passed away 7 months ago today. And it was after a year-long battle with pancreatic cancer. I saw him suffer like no human being should ever have to suffer. But tonight, having held the hand of a good sponsor who was constantly directing me on which way to go, with so much support within this program, I can say that not one time in 19 months have I wanted to take a drink. Not one time in 19 months did I want to be an orange. I tried often to ask God, you know, how can this apple be of service? Dear Lord, let this suffering and this misery be something that I can use for another alcoholic. Let me be an encouragement to those who are struggling, who have to walk through difficult situations in life. You know, this is a gift to be an alcoholic. The one thing that I am so proud of too about this program is that it's given me a faith unlike any kind of religious faith that I had before. You know, the God of my understanding today is my best buddy. You know, he's the one that I go to all hours of the day. The other thing I believe about this program is the steps. So people who know me know that I love those steps. You know, 1, 2, and 3, I'm going to surrender, make a decision about my will. And those are the ones that I have to practice every day, most every hour of every day, because everybody that knows me knows that, you know, I struggle with surrender of my control. I struggle with that, but I have learned to ask God to help me with my will. And the service piece, I love to serve. I'm here tonight with Tim, who's a great mentor for me as far as service work goes. And another thing that I can do today is ask for help. During that period when my husband was sick, I had to ask for a lot of help. It was easy when I first stumbled in the program, but with some days and nights in the program, it is still tough for this alcoholic to ask for help. My sponsor can tell you that it's hard for me to pick up that phone. That's one of the things that I work on. Thank y'all. I think that we are about at the end of our 40 minutes. I appreciate you joining in. It's so cool to see all my buddies, my friend Brian and June from California. Thank you for joining in. All my Earth friends, like I said, y'all have meant the world to me. Tinsley, it's good to see you too. And thanks for all my NABA friends. Y'all come see us at the Halt House or at St. Luke's in Gainesville.
Thank you, Beth. That was incredible. A historic moment for the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting. Everybody give Beth a virtual round of applause. Good job, good job. Next week we have Will D. with the Chapter 3 group of the North Springs United Methodist Church. He will be telling his story. Hopefully, I haven't broken the news to them that it's going to be a Zoom format. Probably enjoyed this, and it meant a lot to you. And please tell others that they can go to aabluechipspeakers.org, download this with 600 other priceless AA recovery stories. I'm going to ask Beth to join me in the Lord's Prayer to close this out. And then I'll unmute everybody and we can have pandemonium. Who grants us serenity?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done,
on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread.
And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Amen. Okay, thanks for coming, everybody.
Upside down, falling off the edge. Just don't sound like fun. We gotta stop fighting everything, everyone. Ought to learn a lesson, breaking all the rules. Try a little session. We're guilty, lost at school. Sleep away the day, hiding from the sun. We gotta stop fighting everything, everyone. Gotta stop.